Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, March 7th, 2024. Tonight's main science topic, I'll be talking about trenches. And these are deep trenches that are all over the world. They're on Mars. We have the Valles Marineris, it's called, on Mars, a very deep trench. We have very visible trenches on planet Earth, like the Grand Canyon. There's some mini Grand Canyons around planet Earth, but the biggies, the big ones, are in the ocean, like the Mariana Trench or the Puerto Rican Trench, the Atacama Trench off of Peru, the west coast of Peru. So I'll be talking about this, and also a couple just quick notes dealing with the planet Mars. Now, on my Picture of the Day subpage a long time ago, and also in the center, I think it's 8 pages of my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. I've got the complete surface of the planet Mars in photographs, high resolution. And that took quite a bit of doing to create that in the book itself, because it was not the regular printing process. So anyway, we had to use a special printing process to print these high-resolution photos in the middle of that book. But the whole point there is that there is very recent water activity on Mars. And then things like the big volcano there on Mars is called Olympus Mons. It is so much bigger. If you took, say, the biggest volcano on Earth, which is Mauna Loa, which is basically the Big Island of Hawaii, and it raises up thousands of feet above the ocean floor down to the base of that volcano, that is dwarfed by Olympus Mons. Olympus Mons is so big that the top sticks out of the atmosphere of Mars, although Mars has a relatively faint atmosphere. But anyway, so I want to talk about the splits in the Earth's crust and mantle, and what are they really caused by? What's causing them? By the way, I'll be on Jeff Wrench's show in a couple hours. When this show ends, clock 2 hours and jump on with Jeff Wrench, and we'll be talking about some interesting topics. Partly about water issues, these plastic that's in water, a new study that has come out on how to cure it. They say boil your water. Anyway, just absurdities. If you went and bought one of these little thin plastic bottles at the gas station or the convenience store, that's where the plastic is. And they're saying, the study says, oh, you should boil that. So what are you going to do? Take it back to your car and boil it before you drink it on your way to work? That's absurdities. Anyway, we'll be talking about that and some other topics. And anyway, so 2 hours after this show ends, I'll be on with Jeff Rentz. I'm on the first Thursday of the month, 9 o'clock Central Time. Okay, another thing I want to quick talk about, which is a related topic here, is they're drilling holes now in Mars, just, you know, these little couple feet deep holes with their little Mars rover thing up there. But every time they look for water, they keep saying, oh, it's ancient water remnants on Mars. The whole point of my weather book, of my other talks, of my Picture of the Day page, and also talks I've given at American Geophysical Union meetings, etc., is that Mars, the water activity on Mars is very, very recent. We're like a couple thousand years ago, water erosion. And there's very good reason for understanding that, because take for example right now, if Earth were to lose its atmosphere, all the water would go away too, because you don't have that atmospheric pressure holding it in place. It would vaporize instantly and simply go away. The Earth's gravitational field holds the atmosphere in place, and that atmospheric pressure is what keeps the water in place. A lot of people don't realize this. But on Mars, when the large comet Venus came by around 1500 BC is our best reckoning. And by the way, this is a little side note. I was just reviewing some documents, and these were documents written by Pontius Pilate. Remember after the crucifixion? Well, you know, as any good general or political figure in the Roman Empire, when stuff went down in your area, you had to write a report and send it back to Rome. And the crucifixion of Christ was such an event, where it was not just your average criminal down the street. This guy was ruffling some feathers. And it turns out that these Herod and Pontius Pilate knew about Christ, and Pontius Pilate actually had contact with Christ long before the time of the few days of the led up to the crucifixion. For example, he recounts a time, this is in his letters, this is in his documentation letters regarding the crucifixion. And he's talking about, he's walking down the road with his staff, and he comes upon this big gathering of people. And Christ is standing up, leaning against a tree, talking to the people, and he has their attention, undivided attention. And also, he was confronted with Jesus, who came in, they brought him in, and they had a personal discussion where Pontius Pilate told him, hey, you know, just calm it down. I don't want to do anything to you. I don't have anything against you, but you got to, like, you know, cool your jets here, because people are getting upset. And, of course, Christ knew this, and he knew what the end was going to be like. He already knew this. But it's very interesting to see the reaction of Pontius Pilate being in the personal presence of Jesus. And he said, this guy, you know, filled the room with his presence and, you know, an amazing personality. The other thing he said is Jesus had golden hair. He didn't say blonde or yellow. He said golden hair. And it was yellow to the extreme. So clearly, and these are Israelites, Hebrews, descendants of Abraham, house of David, Israelites. And more people have been saying this for years and years and years. But more and more people, I'm seeing this come out, and people realizing that when Moses came out of Egypt with the Israelites, they were white, blonde-haired people, blue eyes, and they were a group of people. They were a culture, and they were not slaves like we think of as slaves today in with loincloths and pulling hemp ropes, moving blocks to build pyramids. No, they were artisans. But they were still economically indebted to the Pharaoh because of interest, because of usury fees. And that's how the bankers worked then. That's how they work now. They create usury interest. And, of course, it's going to fail. There's no economy that can withstand usury fees. And that's why for all his difficulties, that's when Hitler got rid of usury fees and banking in the 1930s. Germany prospered beyond belief. They were doing really well. When Gaddafi did the same, he got rid of usury, started his own banking system, they did really well. When the United States, 1776, the revolution was about usury and taxation on individuals. When they got rid of that, everybody did really well. And of course, by the 1800s, it was even the early 1800s, 1812, the War of 1812 was brought on by the bankers. The Civil War was brought on by the bankers. It was not about slavery. Everybody was ready to give up slavery. But it was about the North driving the South to pay for it by taxation, to pay for the industrial wars that going on in the north. That's what it was all about. And so anyway, wherever you see it, Venezuela, where they had tremendous amount of money coming in, and they thumbed their nose up to the banking system. Okay, I could go on and on. But anyway, back into the time when Pontius Pilate was encountering Jesus, like I say, leaning up against a tree, was a descendant of the house of David. That's what the trip to Bethlehem was all about, was the census. The Romans were taking a census, and at that time, that's when Jesus was born. Okay, so at any rate, kind of rambling on here about a few things, the point I was trying to make, dealing with this history of Moses coming out of Egypt, and that is the time period when this large comet Venus came through the solar system, wreaking havoc with Mars, and then also with planet Earth. And this is well recounted in the Mayan Popol Vuh, the Peruvian, the Incas talk about this in their history. The Aztecs were one generation removed, one generation of, not like a human generation, but a generation, civilization generation, away from the Mayas and the Toltecs, whose history did go back to the Venus event. Okay, so at any rate, and it was Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, was the planet Venus. So you have like Chichen Itza is dedicated, the altar, the main altar at Chichen Itza is dedicated to Venus. It's not the sun, it's not the pyramid of the sun. Like everybody goes there and watches the on the spring solstice that the stairs move, the shadow. No, that was never meant to be like that. That's a farce, a complete farce. The reason for the if the the Great Pyramid at Chichen Itza were built on the north, south, east, west lines, like it would have been if it were actually built from scratch in the 800s, as the modern archaeologists talk about, it wouldn't be 13 and a half degrees off. I've been there, I've surveyed it myself on the ground, boots on the ground. So I don't have to read this in a book to tell you about it. I went and did that myself so that I could understand, and then retro measured the old North Pole, which was in the Hudson's Bay, before the pole shift. Earth had a severe pole shift. And during this, there were mountain building events. So if you have mountain building events where land comes together and is upthrust overnight, just like literally overnight, then something else has to give someplace else. And that's where the earth trenches come in. Now, if you look at standard geology, what they're going to try and tell you is that these plates are, one is subducting under the other plate and sliding down, and that the plates are moving all by themselves. But it's simply not true. There's all kinds of faults with this, because in a real world, you would think, okay, something is falling down and then something is rising up over it. Well, where are the forces involved here? What is the cause of the forces that make entire continents move sideways in one piece? Part of the problem here, in fact, I would say 90% of the problem here, is this terminology called plate tectonics. Plate, you think of a plate, you go eat dinner, you put food on it, you take it over and you put it on the table. You pick up that plate on the side, if it's properly made, even a thin plate is one piece. And by picking it up at the edge, even with food on there, it's not going to break and fall off. But Earth's surface and the so-called plates are not like that. People get this idea that there's some kind of rigid plate there moving around, and that if the plate moves over here by the so-called subduction edge, that the whole plate is moving. and that this is like one solid piece. And there's, I remember there's a interesting photograph from one of the physics books we had when we were undergrads. It was called Holliday and Resnick, classic physics textbook used for probably almost everybody in basic physics, in physics majors. And there's a photo there of a crane trying to pick up a piece of earth. And that the big chainsaws had cut the crust and the mantle of the earth. And then this crane is trying to pick it up. And the point is that if, you know, say you pick up a piece of granite and you carve a monolith out of it, 100 feet long, it's pretty much one piece. But if you picked it up without supporting it, supporting it well along its entire length, the chances are that thing's going to break off somewhere in the middle. This is solid granite. If you took a piece of granite 200 or 300 or 400 feet long, or 500 or 600 feet long, and you try and pick it up at one end, that thing's going to break in two. So that's the relative strength of say granite, probably one of the most solid rocks that develop, you know, deep in the earth where there's a lot of pressure forcing these rocks to form. But if you take earth in general, if you take it on a mile long scale, there's nothing in the earth's mantle or plate that is going to sustain the pressure. So if, well, here's another example. Imagine that you can take and cut the earth along a certain line and get a bunch of bulldozers in there. Flying into Denver is a good example. Just west of Denver, there's a fault line. And it's split, you know. But what if you could, like, get down into that fault crevice and with great big hydraulic machines with big structures on one side and big structures like a plow, you know, and you all of a sudden you activate the hydraulics and you start pushing apart. So one plate is pushing against another plate. Do you know what would happen? You would get deformation locally, and that's it. It's the same thing. There's another grave error that is made in geology and in space science, etc. When an object comes in and hits the Earth, or hits the Moon, or some other object in outer space, what happens is the vast majority of that energy is expended locally. In other words, there's a tremendous amount of heat, and that shock goes into crushing rock, etc. There's a great picture of, I've been at a location called Winslow, Arizona. There's a crater there. And the crater, there was a small piece of material there. They've got it in the museum that's right there at the location. There's a little museum. But this is what? I don't know if it's a mile wide. It's a big hole in the ground, and this small chunk of stuff hit there. But the idea is that, of course, the material got blasted out to form this crater, and then it's on the lip of the crater. It's like bowed up where the impact pushed and blew all this material out. And, of course, that material probably blew out for miles around there. But the point is that the majority of that energy was absorbed locally. And even if you get up to pretty big craters, that energy is absorbed locally. And I think one of the big overestimations is the destruction that asteroids would have on planet Earth, believing that it would cause this firestorm around the Earth and everything would burn and everybody would die. So at any rate, it's the same issue, however, as the issue of plate tectonics, that the Earth is a pliable material. And Elon Musk was, I saw him in an interview the other day, and, you know, he's a physicist by training and also a pretty astute business person, whether you agree with everything he does or not. But he said the Earth is basically a molten ball, which it is, with a very thin shell on the cover, and that's it. That's the story of Earth. And so when you have a large object passing by, the wave that's set up, the gravitational wave, is pretty intense. It's like a wave in a liquid with this thin crust on it. If you look at the biggest mountain on Earth, the altitude of the biggest mountain on Earth, on a just a regular globe, like a globe that you would hold in your hand, the highest elevation is thinner than a sheet of paper in the lowest depression in the ocean. Okay, so with this as somewhat of a beginning, I'm going to start talking about the trenches around the world. And there's about 20 of them. I'll read off a few of them and talk a little bit about their depths. And I'm going to be giving their depths in kilometers. So a kilometer is what, 0.6 of a mile? Just to give you a rough feeling. So the deepest trench in the world is the Mariana Trench. It's out in the Pacific Ocean, 10.9 kilometers deep. Now, that's down there a ways. So these are trenches, and the ambient ocean level is much less. The depth of the ocean near the Mariana Trench or any of these trenches is much less. So it's literally a trench that just goes way down into the ground. And you could compare it by inverting, say, Mount Everest. And this is something they do in artist conception, just to give you a feel for the Mariana Trench or any of the other ones. Then these 10.9 kilometers deep at its deepest point. Tonga, which is also in the South Pacific. In fact, all of the deepest ones, interestingly enough, are in the Pacific Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean and the Caribbean have some also. Not quite so deep, but still serious scars in the surface of the Earth. So it's the Mariana Trench is the deepest, the Tonga Trench, the Philippine Trench is right up there with them, just a nick away from the deepest, 10.5 kilometers. The Kamchatka Trench is off of basically the Kamchatka Peninsula that sticks out in Russia, which almost connects to Alaska. That's that region up there, northeast Alaska, which is a highly volcanic area. Then you have the next in line, number eight in line in terms of depth, is the Puerto Rico Trench, 8.4 kilometers deep. And I spent quite a bit of time in Puerto Rico. They have an average of 11 earthquakes per day there. And it's like you don't even notice it. But the good thing is that the little earthquakes are good because that means that the plates are sliding against each other constantly, sliding and sliding. And so therefore, it's like what happens with a big earthquake is that the plates are binding up energy and they're binding together. And then all of a sudden, one day, wham, they unload. And that's where you get the big earthquakes. It's where the trenches are locked together. Where the plates boundaries are locked together and they're pressing. And all of a sudden they let go. And so that's where the big earthquakes come from. So in Puerto Rico, you have lots and lots of hundreds per month earthquakes, little ones, and therefore you don't really have the big ones. Number 10 on the list is the Atacama Trench. This is also called the Peru-Chile Trench, and it runs the entire west coast of South America. It's just a little bit offshore, and it follows that curvy line, and then straight when you get down to Argentina in Chile, you get that the western coast there, you get the Atacama Trench, 8 kilometers deep at its deepest point. And it runs that whole coastline. And then you have the Pacific Trench that is connecting there. And then you go all the way down to about 19th or 20th on the list is the Puerto Rico Bermuda Trench, which is different than the Puerto Rican Trench. The Puerto Rican Trench, Puerto Rico Trench, is just off the northern coast of Puerto Rico. The Puerto Rico Bermuda Trench is another third or another part of the triangle, the what we call the Bermuda Triangle. And there, I'll just give you a little side. You've heard the everybody knows about the Bermuda Triangle, where ships disappear and airplanes disappear, and it can be a place where stuff just disappears. You know, there are stories of World War II aircraft flying in the area, and all of a sudden they start reporting on the radio that they have this, everything is turning orange, and their magnetic compasses are going haywire. Of course, that's long before GPS. So their compasses are going haywire, and all of a sudden they disappear off the map. They just simply disappear and are never seen again. A bunch of, I think they were like Avenger class World War II aircraft carrier airplanes. There have been ships that simply are going along and then all of a sudden disappear, but they give the same story. The radio, as they're, you know, going out of sight, there's a SOS radio announcement that they're in this orange cloud and the magnetic compasses are going crazy, and all of a sudden they disappear, never to be seen again. So anyway, what I am convinced in the Bermuda Triangle that it's real. There's real events that happen there. It's probably a place you don't want to be in for a long period of time, and here's what's going on. You have the Bermuda Trench, the Puerto Rico Bermuda Trench, and the other volcanic activity that's down there. And so what happens is a big bubble of gas comes up, and of course this is sulfur dioxide gas and other volcanic related gases, which are orange. If you've ever been near a volcano and looked at the vents coming out, if you're near a volcano, if it's like, say, a national park or a restricted area, they say do not breathe the gas that's coming venting out of the ground, because it'll kill you. It'll kill you right now. And highly toxic gases coming out of these volcanoes. But when a volcano erupts, it's not so obvious, because you see a lot of ash, that's the visible part, but there's a lot of gas involved in the explosion. In fact, this is what is basically going on. The real reason, when you get the explosive types of volcanoes, the real reason for that is that water is, these water pockets are down in the earth. All of a sudden there's a fissure and that water goes down and hits the magma, where it turns into steam. And so basically you have a steam engine, like a piston, and it's already broken this hole in the ground at the surface of the earth. So that's the path of least resistance, or in the case of something like Mount St. Helens, it just blows the entire side of the mountain off. I mean, it's a lot of power, and it takes that material and blows it up into the stratosphere on the really powerful volcanoes, and then that takes the this powder and it blows it around the entire earth. Right now, by the way, there is a volcano going off, activating right outside of Mexico City, a place I used to live when I was younger. And every morning I would get up and look out my window. I lived in a high-rise apartment on the southwest corner of the city with a view to the east. And every morning I'd get up and one half of my wall was window. It went wall to wall, but from about waist high up, the entire wall was window. And looking out over Mexico City, to the east were the two mountains, Iztaccíhuatl and Popocatépetl. And Popol right now is going off. It's one of the world's active volcanoes. And so nobody knows if this thing is going to really blow. It's probably overdue. The last big explosion was around 800 AD, and it's on about a 1,200-year cycle. So it could be due, it could be overdue, it could have a major eruption at any time. And there's 25 million people living in the basin there. In fact, Mexico City itself is a volcanic caldera. When the Aztecs were living there, there was a lake there, still had the lake, the remnant of the lake from the ancient volcano. But the Popocatépetl is the one that's erupting right now. But anyway, what happens when a volcano erupts? There's a lot of gas that comes out also. So if this is an underwater volcano that's erupting, you're getting a lot of ash, and of course that probably settles down very quickly because of water resistance, etc. It probably settles down very quickly on the ocean floor, but the gas is going to go up like a giant bubble, and it's going to be orange in color, and also you're going to have a lot of magnetic activity because of the magma, which has a lot of iron in it, moving, causing electrical currents, etc. And which is part of the Earth's electric, basically electrical circuit of Earth. And so you're going to have a lot of electrical activity, which is going to cause the compasses to go haywire. And then this enormous orange bubble coming up. So imagine you're a big ship, 200, 300 feet long, 400, 500 feet long, maybe a big ship. And this bubble comes up. Well, hey, that ship's going to go down maybe a few hundred feet, maybe even more. And it's going to nose down and it'll just never come back up. And it's going to happen in a second or two. All of a sudden, there's probably a lot of gas coming out of the water, orange gas, and that's what these ships reported before they disappeared. So that's the clear explanation. People talk about aliens coming in and taking entire ships away. No, that's what's going on in the Bermuda Triangle. And so if you look at these trenches, now let's look at some trenches that are not under the ocean. Just about everything I read off here, the Mariana, the Tonga, the Philippine, the Kamchatka, the Puerto Rico Trench, the Atacama Trench, the Puerto Rico Bermuda Trench, these are all underwater. All underwater. And then, but there are some trenches that are above, on the surface of the Earth. For example, the Grand Canyon. And as I said before, the Valles Marineris on Mars. Now, I had the opportunity to fly up over the Grand Canyon in an airplane. And on the northern end. On the northern end. And it's just like the ground split apart. It's like there's perfectly stable land, and all of a sudden there's just like a crack in the earth, and it opens up into the Grand Canyon. Go check it out if you have an opportunity to fly over the Grand Canyon on the northeast side. Like I say, it's just like there's perfectly normal land, and all of a sudden it splits and goes off. And so what's going on with these trenches is that when a large comet comes by, there are two things that can happen. With the wave, the land wave, as that rolls up against another obstruction like an existing mountain range or whatever, it's going to, that wave of energy, the literally a wave, it could be 1,000 feet high energy wave of land, hits that mountain range, and all that energy is absorbed, and it creates mountains. The ancients talk about this. The Colburn talks about it. The ancient texts talk about it. The Mayan Popol Vuh talks about it. About the Quetzalcoatl carrying the oceans on its back and creating mountains. Okay, so at any rate, that's one effect of a large planetary object in the form of a comet coming by planet Earth. The other effect is if you're having compression and mountain building over here, well, something's got to give. And that's where the trenches come in. So it's not plates subducting one under the other. Well, sure, that's what's left as these plate boundaries jam together as this gravitational wave passed over. Sure, one's going to have to go up over the other one. And that's what's happening. But it's not this simplistic view that the Earth is just doing this all by itself. And that's the point here. That, as with any geology or geological theories or this idea of plate tectonics, etc., that you have to look, as a physicist, you have to look, if there's something happening, you need energy, you need forces, you have to identify them. For example, if you never saw a car before, okay, you come to a place, you're a person that's never seen a car before, you go out on the street, and all of a sudden this car goes down the street, and you go, whoa, what's that? And then, of course, the first thing you're going to try and figure out, if you're a physicist, is what's making this thing move. And so one might look, and you go around and examine the car, and there's exhaust coming out the exhaust pipe, and you think, well, Newton's laws, you know, action and reaction, the gas coming out this pipe must be making the car go down the street. And then you go, well, wait a minute. If you measure the amount of gas coming out the tailpipe, it's really not very much. And it's not enough matter to make this 2,000-pound car go the other way. So Newton's law, which we know is true, doesn't explain where the energy is coming from to make this car go down the street. You know, and so you have to look further. So then you go around and you open up the hood and you find this gas-guzzling engine that's connected to a transmission that's connected to the tires, and that's what makes the car go down the road. So your first impression, that is the exhaust coming out the tailpipe, it was a good guess, but it doesn't hold water. Because why? There wasn't enough energy there. There was not enough force there to produce the effect that you're seeing. Okay, the same holds true for plate tectonics. Where's the force? Where's the energy source? And people say, oh, well, there's this upwelling of heat coming from the earth. Well, that's coming from all over. And I call it the hammock problem. If you're in a hammock, okay, and the ropes come one out one side, one out the other, and you tie it against a couple of trees. Okay, so you get in the hammock, say you weigh 100 pounds. And you get in the hammock, okay, so that's the force vector that's down, is 100 pounds. But the cords are sticking out sideways, kind of at an angle upwards. So the vertical support of that hammock has got to support 100 pounds. But the ropes are not vertical, they're at an angle. So you calculate the force vector, and now you have to you can determine the amount of force on the ropes holding this 100-pound person up, and it's usually maybe even 10 or 20 times more than the weight of the person. That's how much tension is on the cords of the hammock. You understand? And so anyway, do the opposite of the hammock problem. That's why I call it the hammock problem, and this is the problem with plate tectonics. People say, oh, there's an upward force due to the heat upwelling, you know, volcanism on planet Earth. Okay, so now if you push up on a plate, that's a vertical force. To translate that into a horizontal force is almost infinite, because it's perpendicular to the direction of the heat, the alleged heat force, pushing upwards on the plate. How do you get that translated into a horizontal force to make the plate move sideways? You have to find the force that's causing this plate tectonic movement. And of course, you can't find it. But let's play devil's advocate here, and let's pretend you could find it. Let's pretend that you have found the force that could push entire continents sideways. So now you put your machine up against the plate boundary and you push as hard as you can to make that plate move sideways. Well, what's going to happen? You get back to the problem that the Earth is compressible, and all of the force that you're pushing with is only going to compress the Earth locally. It's not going to make the plate out there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean dive down under another plate. It's simply not going to happen. So you first of all, there is no force. There's no identifiable force, and even if you found it, it wouldn't work. So the reason I'm talking about this is because we see these trenches on planet Earth, and they are the result of passing comets. They're the signatures, they're the scars, if you will, of large passing comets. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is, I've been talking about gravitational waves and large passing comets, etc. So I'm going to go through some examples here and talk about sizing up, for example, what is a large comet? So let's take, first of all, a small comet, like, say, Halley's Comet. And, of course, astronomers will swear on a stack of Bibles that, oh, there cannot be big comets. Categorically lied about the size of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, saying it was, oh, big, 42 miles across. No, the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was planetary size. But, of course, NASA lies through its teeth about just about everything. When I'm talking about a large comet, I'm not talking about the powder puff little comets like Halley's or 99% of all other comets that we see. And then let me just explain this. In terms of size, let's look at a ratio. Let's take a ratio. Let's take, for example, here's a good example. Take a big rock with a sledgehammer, and you start pounding on this rock, and after 3-4 hours of work of breaking the rock into pieces, you might have some big pieces left over and some medium pieces, but a lot of it is in the form of just almost dust because you've been working on this rock. And so that you would call a size distribution. And so let's say, for example, you take and you measure all of the pieces, little pieces of the rock that have been, you know, that are laying around. And you take the very smallest ones and you count those, then you take the next size and you count those, and then the next size and you count those, and you make a distribution. And what's generally going to happen is you're going to have a lot of little ones, little teeny ones, the smallest ones. You're going to have not so many of the next size up. You're going to have fewer yet of the next size up, and when you get up to the great big pieces, you might have 2 or 3. That's the same thing that happens with objects in outer space. And it's not because they were smashed by a hammer, it's just because, well, in a sense, a lot of them were. A lot of them are the aftermath of, say, planets colliding or other objects smashing together, literally, which is a rare event, but or possibly an explosion in a star or whatever. But the size distribution of objects is going to be variable. And then in terms of the plasma discharge comet model, they come into a solar system and they start building up material. The small ones don't have enough gravitational force to keep the material that they gather locally, so it blows away in the solar wind. And that might convince you that material is coming off the nucleus, when in fact it's first of all being drawn into the nucleus. But I don't want to get into the small comets. What I want to talk about are the big ones. The big ones that have potential to do damage on Earth or Mars or any of the other planets or Moon, etc. And by the way, one of the issues with our Moon and the age of the solar system is that our Moon could not possibly be very old. Why? Because its orbit is tilted. It is askew from the plane of the planets. And here's what happens. When an object like the Moon is down below the plane of the planets, Jupiter and the Sun and Earth, the other planets are pulling up on it. And when it's up above the plane of the planets, Jupiter and the Sun, etc., they are collectively pulling down on it. And so it's constantly working itself into the plane of the planets, and after a few million, let's say a few hundred million years, it's going to work that orbit nicely into the plane of the planets, and that's why all of the planets, etc., are in a single plane. It's because of that constant working, gravitational working, to bring everything into a single plane, with the Sun and Jupiter being the dominant forces. Because Jupiter is, what, 100,000 times more massive than Earth? And the Sun is another 100,000 times more massive than Jupiter. So those are just round numbers, and the end result is that the size distribution of objects in the solar system, and you can see that with the planets too. If you take all the planets and moons and Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus, Neptune, all the planets and all of the moons, etc., and you line them up, there's going to be lots and lots of little ones. There's going to be not so many bigger ones. There's going to be fewer yet of the bigger ones, and all the way up to Jupiter, you have one that's Jupiter size. Okay, and so the same thing is true of comets and comet nuclei, but the big ones exist. And you don't need to see them to know they exist. They're actually finding out in the Kuiper Belt, they're actually finding Jupiter-sized objects out there, but they're not talking about it. And I know the reason, I can tell that they are finding these because there's leaks that come out. Okay, so anyway, now what I want to talk about is what's going to happen to Earth. And now, by the way, this is not something that, don't say James McCanney is saying there's a big object coming into the solar system. No, that is not what I'm saying. I'm giving hypothetical examples of what would happen if a large object would come through the solar system, as has happened historically. In the case of Venus, Venus was not quite as large as Earth, but we know from the Mayans, we know from the Colbran, the ancient books of the Library of Joseph Arimathea, we know from these ancient texts what happened. And one of them is that, explained in terms of physics, the wave that is set up, now it's like a water wave, but on land. And so, when we have the tide every day, the tides raise and lower, as much as, say, 15 feet or more in some place, depending on where you are. The tide in the ocean raises, and it was what we call the tides. And so that's just from our moon and the Earth spinning underneath our moon. And that's a relatively benign interaction. If the Earth and moon were closer, we would have a much bigger tide, it would go much farther inland, and we would have very little land that was stable on a daily basis, much less than we do now. But luckily, the Earth tides are not that great. It's almost like somebody planned it, almost like with the moon, with the eclipse coming up, the moon is exactly the right size to completely block out the sun, if you're in the path of totality of the lunar eclipse, or of the solar eclipse that's coming up very soon here. It's almost like somebody planted it there just to give us a bird's eye view of the sun and understanding what the sun looks like before there were telescopes, before there were solar viewing telescopes that could do that. Okay, so imagine this large physical object is coming by Earth. It's coming by relatively fast, maybe 20,000, maybe 30,000 miles an hour. And so the wave on Earth due to the lunar tide is only about 1,000 miles per hour. So imagine that the velocity of this big object coming by would be 20 times. Now that has a big effect on the wave that is formed, and not only an ocean wave, but a wave in the land. Now imagine also that this object is much bigger than the moon. And so the gravitational force, and therefore the differential gravitational force, which is what causes the tides, is much greater. And so the end result is you have potentially a land wave in the land, maybe 200-300 feet high, maybe 500 feet, maybe 1,000 feet, when it's in a very severe case. And so you have this land wave moving across that is like literally a wave. It's like a wave on the ocean. And you can see the results of these. There was a listener that sent in a picture. It was a very interesting photograph. It was kind of rolling hills, but the photograph focused on a open segment that had like broken away, and you could see down into the ground where the land had literally buckled because of a wave. And this is due to literally a wave moving in the ground. Now, back again to the somebody might say, well, that's plate tectonics. Well, no, once again, the ground, if there is some kind of force somewhere pushing entire plates around, then the energy, just like the asteroid hitting the Earth, the energy is going to be absorbed locally. It's not going to move something 1,000 miles away. And so you could actually see how the ground had buckled under these rolling hills. And the ground was deformed in the form of a wave that had rolled over. And you know, when you're at the ocean and the waves come in, what's happening is there's a, in a sense, a viscosity of friction at the bottom of the wave. So the wave is moving on the ocean, and the bottom of the wave slows down. So that makes the top of the wave move ahead, and then it raises up because there's an upward force, a ground effect, so to speak. The wave raises up and it breaks and it falls over, and that's what you see, a breaking wave on the shore. Well, the land does the same thing. But when that wave hits an existing land mass or obstruction, like a mountain range, then that's where the mountain building comes from. So that energy is absorbed into the mountain range. If you go to, let's see, I've been on many, many mountain ranges on the planet, but a real great example is the southern region of the Rocky Mountains down in southern Colorado by Durango. And you go north of there just a little bit, and you'll see one end of the Rocky Mountains. But you can see there where the waves came in from many different directions, building up mountains at various times during the history of the Earth. So there have been major mountain building events probably 20 to 30 times on planet Earth, and then probably hundreds of smaller ones. The Venus Passage would have been a smaller mountain building event, but it was enough also to cause about a 35 degree shift in the pole, the rotational poles of planet Earth. And then also you might think, well, how long are these waves in terms of longitudinal length? And so they would probably go for between 6 to 8,000 miles. In other words, about a quarter of the way around the Earth, because literally the gravitational wave from the passing comet would induce that wide a wave, so a tremendous amount of energy. Okay, well, that's all well and good. Also, with plate tectonics, there's no way that you could push on a plate from the side and cause it to buckle up and lift up this tremendous amount of weight. As I said before, the land where the force was acting would deform at that point, not 1,000 miles or 3,000 miles away in the middle of the continent, and form mountains. You have to understand the tremendous amount of work it takes to lift these mountains up into the air. Tremendous amount of work. And so this doesn't happen because of plate tectonics. It just doesn't make any sense. And the reason is because most geologists probably dropped out of physics around their sophomore year in college, maybe didn't even make it that far. So they don't understand physics, which is the case with a lot of space scientists, with a lot of astronomers. They don't have a decent physics background. They have some basics, and they have some basic tools that they've learned how to use. But in terms of really understanding physics and the level of forces and energy involved in planetary formation, they don't have a clue. And so that's why these ridiculous theories can be propagated and accentuated over literally centuries now. Okay, so now I was talking about mountain building. So just as you can have regions where land accumulates, then something else has to give someplace else, and that's where the trenches come in. It's very interesting to see that there probably are the same number of major trenches as there are mountain ranges, about 20. And so you can see, for example, the Kamchatka, I'm sorry, Kamchatka, I have to say it correctly, Kamchatka Peninsula mountain range. That's very active volcanically, and right off of there is the Kamchatka trench, 10,500 feet meters deep, or 10.5 kilometers deep. And so the trenches are also visible, and of course they happen at a lot of times at what you would, you know, the traditional term would be the plate boundaries. But there again, I really don't like using those terms because they're not realistic. We got to get used to using and creating other terms. Plate is a bad word because the world, these sections of property are not plate-like. They're not a solid plate. In fact, they, if on a 1 to 2 mile basis only, they are not, they're not rigid. They're not like a plate. So the idea of a plate is absurd. It's absolutely ridiculous. So I hope this, I've talked about these topics before, but tonight I wanted to concentrate on the trenches. We always talk about mountain building, but we've kind of forgot about these trenches. And literally all of them are underwater, except for the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is a remarkable geological configuration. I hope most of you have been there. And there's a issue also with the Via Marineris on Mars. It doesn't look like a simple split in the surface, although possibly that's what it was due to. There were other factors involved there. And so there are people that suggest that it was due to an electrical discharge that cut across the planet. Once we get to Mars and start looking, if that were the case, then you would have all of that land that is missing, all of the material that is missing from the Via Marineris groove in the ground, basically a quarter of the way around the planet Mars, would be in the form of small beads. They're called, slang term is the blueberries. In other words, glassification of the sediment, the silicates, when the tremendous heat would have been occurring there. But at any rate, so far, the tremendous amount of glass beads has not shown up to that would confirm that that was an electrical discharge cut. And so that's what you would look for, the telltale signs. Okay, I'm about out of time here. Just want to let you know that my webpage, jmccsci.com, the webpage is back up and operating in terms of selling the books and other products. My webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, go there, use your 5% discount code, JMCC, those four letters, get a 5% discount on any orders over $300. Once again, the webpage is jmccsci.com and jmccwaterfilters.com. And remember, in 2 hours, join me as I talk with Jeff Rentz about quite a few different topics. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.